Hello, listener. Welcome to the University of Maryland Extension presents the Garden Time Podcast, where we talk about getting down and dirty in your garden. We're your hosts. I'm Michaela.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Emily.
And in this month's episode, we're chatting about herbs and all things herbs. So herbs are beloved by all people, whether you're doing a vegetable garden or not a vegetable garden. There's just something very charismatic and multifaceted about herbs. There's a lot of uses, whether you use them for food and in cooking, or you're just going to attract some pollinators. There's a lot of history involved with the use of herbs. And Rachel, you're our resident herb expert. You can tell us, what is an herb?
Okay, so any plant with leaves, seeds, or flowers used for flavoring food, medicine, or perfume is classified as an herb. The use of plants as herbs has been important to all cultures. Hundreds of tribal cultures have used wild or cultivated herbs for medicinal and food purposes for thousands of years. Egyptian schools of herbalists have existed since 3000 BC. Herbs are mentioned in Genesis, the first chapter of the Bible, and throughout its text. As civilizations developed, so did their knowledge for the uses of herbs. Scholars were interested in herbs for medicine, cosmetics, cooking. In the past, herbs were only available during warm months of the growing season, and at other times, consumers had to purchase dried herbs. Today, the business of producing fresh herbs for consumption has become one of the fastest growing industries in agriculture. The United States produces about 200 billion pounds of herbs and spices per year. That's a huge market.
And that's a lot of plants.
It is a lot of plants.
And I'll tell you what, fresh herbs are worth their weight in gold. So even the stuff on the shelves that's dried doesn't even compare. The flavor is so different.
I 100% agree. You know, I do a lot of cooking with herbs. And for the summer, I usually stock up on things and I make huge amounts of broth for the winter. And if I have to make it in the winter, the taste is just completely different because I don't have those fresh herbs.
What's really wonderful about herbs is that you can use them in containers, so they can be in smaller spaces, especially for people who don't have raised beds or a big garden to work with. Sometimes you can grow them inside, but they have a little bit more light requirements than some houseplants. So you either need lights or something like that, but they can be grown inside is one of the things I'm trying to say. I also really think they make great projects for working with children or sensory gardens because you're utilizing all different types of senses, such as smell, touch, feel, all that kind of thing.
I completely agree. You know, I only have a few herbs that I actually plant in the ground. Most of my herbs are done in containers or raised beds. And most of my container herbs actually will overwinter if I put them in a protected spot, either along the side of my house or the side of our garage, just to get them through the year. And if I know we're going to have a heavy frost, I just cover them with some floating row cover and they'll keep on ticking.
Well, and I know this is pretty specific to the Eastern Shore, but because our soils are so heavy and wet, sometimes it's actually better to grow a lot of herbs in containers because they tend to prefer being dried out a little bit more in comparison with the soil that holds on to moisture.
And that's primarily because most of our herbs are Mediterranean or from like Turkey or Asia. So they like that dry climate, that dry soil. So I think when you pick out an herb for your garden, you really need to do your due diligence and look at where that plant came from in order to know their growing requirements.
Yeah, exactly. It's no wonder that I kill at least one rosemary plant a year, even though it's a perennial, because I inevitably try and put it in a place that doesn't get dry enough. And the rosemary is definitely a Mediterranean plant that likes a little bit sandier soil than I have.
Yeah, you got to put it in a container. It'd be fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I also think that herbs are probably one of the plants that you get the most bang for your buck for, because if you have a small herb garden, you can season basically any food. that can go a really long way. And especially if you figure out how to, you know, harvest them and dry them, you can use them all winter long. Herbs, I think, are one of the most expensive things that you buy in a grocery store. So
they are. I just paid $3 for a bunch of dill. And I was like, oh.
Yeah. And come midsummer, you're going to have dill coming out of your ears. And how often do you use dill, really?
I know. And I buy dill specifically for making broth. And I was like, oh, I hate to spend $3 on this bunch.
One of the other great things about herbs is many of them grow very well from seed. So it can be a cheap sort of activity to invest in. But they also are offered as transplants, or you can do clippings of them for propagation.
Yeah.
There are some species that probably grow from seed a lot better than others. Basil is probably pretty easy to do from seed. Dill self-seeds very readily. Some that may take a really long time to grow from seed are chives, because they're kind of like a type of onion. And so it might be worth investing in actual transplants and seedlings from those. What are some others that make better transplants versus?
Thyme.
Okay, sure, sure. Any of the like woodier, like rosemary, definitely lavender. I've never had any good success starting lavender from seed.
You know, I have only had success growing lavender from seed when it's been in the greenhouse. And it usually takes about 2 to 3 years to have a plant that's ready to go out in the garden.
Yeah, a lot of those woodier plants take a lot more time because they're perennial, basically.
Yeah. So I will say some really good ones that you can direct seed now and still get them in time to use this spring and summer would be things like common chamomile, cilantro, and dill.
Yep.
As long as you put them direct seed right after that first frost date, it takes a few weeks to germinate and start coming up. Versus some of these other ones, you definitely, if you want to use them this year, would need to be buying them as transplants at this point.
I feel like dill is one of those herbs that if you haven't had success doing things from seed, then you need to plant dill, because it is very easy to germinate, and then you have mountains of it, and it's just like, oh, wow, look at all this dill I have, you know, like it's such an easy germinator. So today we're going to chat about some common herbs to use for cooking and growing in your garden. So Michaela, can you tell me about growing basil?
So basil is actually quite a big group, because it's a member of a very large family, the mint or Lamiaceae family. And this is actually an annual herb. So just the garden variety like Italian basil is an annual herb grown for very flavorful leaves. Although we associate it with a lot of a type of Italian food, basil is likely native to India and is widely grown as a kitchen herb. One of my favorite basils is Thai basil. I actually prefer that over some of the other Italian varieties. So like most herbs, the leaves are best enjoyed fresh, but can also be dried or frozen for winter use. I don't know, Rachel, if you have a preference for dried versus frozen.
I see, you like Thai basil. I love just regular sweet basil. And I usually, when I harvest it, I usually make pesto by the boatloads and then freeze it. Or I do an ice cube tray with olive oil and put my fresh basil in that. And that's how I freeze it.
There are over 160 cultivars to choose from. So there should be something for everybody. And there's a purple variety. There's just green varieties. I talked about Thai basil, but all of them are delicious, fragrant, and add even ornamental interest to the garden. So even though I like Thai basil, I actually don't use a lot of it, but I like how it looks and I like how it attracts pollinators. And these grow actually very fragrant flowers that are really good for pollinators, even though we tend to recommend pinching back the flower buds so that you can increase the growth of the leaves. As far as growing conditions, basil is one of those plants that needs a lot of sun, and it does like more of like the dry heat. So it'll grow in a location that gets 6 to 8 hours of full sun daily. Although sometimes they can perform in partial sun, I think they get a little bit leggy. I prefer full sun.
I agree. And I think that when they get like partial sun, they're more prone to like downy mildew. So I like mine to be in full sun where I barely water it at all.
Yeah. going back and pinching back is not only good because it prevents it from flowering, but also by pinching it back and opening it up, you will reduce your likelihood of getting things like downy mildew on it because it'll dry itself out.
Exactly. And so it's actually encouraged to use the leaves as the plant grows because you're providing better air circulation by pinching back some of those parts of the plant.
That's great advice.
So you want the soil to be moist but well-drained. So these make really great container or raised bed herbs. And they allow for a little bit better drainage. So this is something that can work well, especially if you're working with kids or you have like a little patio garden. Make sure that you can complement your containers by putting some basil and planting some basil in them. So again, as we mentioned, for summer care, we want to talk about pruning it back to promote growth, but also to help kind of keep air circulation better and reduce your chance of disease. And if your basil starts to sprout flowers, you can feel free either leave some for the pollinators, or you can pinch those flowers back so that you can keep the leaf production going. Flowers are an indication that the basil is going to go to seed, so to speak. So it means it puts growing energy into making the flowers versus the leaves. And then it kind of changes the taste and makes it a little bit more bitter.
Yeah, that's also a time where if you decide you want to go ahead and let it go to flower, you can oftentimes just go buy a new basil plant someplace for a few dollars, especially if you notice that it has started to go bitter and you are a person who's adamantly cooking with it.
And I know a lot of people try and get them to overwinter by bringing them indoors, but these really do kind of serve best as an annual herb. And you know, it's okay to freeze some of those leaves for winter use, but they tend to get a little leggy and a little sad in the winter when you bring them indoors.
It's very true.
I have one sad one that's been sitting on my countertop.
They do look so sad after a while.
I'm hoping I'm going to move it out pretty soon.
Okay.
And it's really easy to take a branch off of that basil plant too and put it in some water and root it for another plant too.
That's a great idea.
Really, really easy to do.
So Rachel, you want to tell us a little bit about chives?
I love growing chives. And I have had my one bunch of chives for about 6 years in my raised bed. And there's nothing better than seeing those purple flowers in the spring with like all the bees all over it. So chives is one of my favorite things to grow. Originally, chives were found in Europe and they've been used for centuries, but not actively cultivated until the Middle Ages in Europe. They're related to the lily family. So when you think about the lily family, onions, garlic, leeks are also members. Chives are actually a perennial. So you will have chives for years to come if you plant them in your garden. They're a great springtime herb and they don't require very much maintenance at all. Chives flavor don't stand up well to heat. So it's best to use them as a garnish on salads, soups, potatoes, or you can infuse them with butter. Chive butter is amazing. So because they don't stand up well to heat, we classify them as a cool season, cold tolerant perennial. So we recommend planting them in early spring or for a late spring, early summer harvest. There are two common species of chives grown in home gardens, common chives and garlic chives. Common chives has consistent small clumps and slender bulbs that produce thin tubular blue-green leaves, and they reach about 15 inches in height, and their flowers are edible, and the flowers are usually white, pink, purple, or red, and they can be grown in zones 3 to 9. Garlic chives look very similar to common chives, but their leaves are actually flat, almost like a blade of grass you would think about. And their leaves are more green. They also get taller. So they're going to be about 20 inches in height. And as their name suggests, they have more of a garlic flavor and their bulbs are more intense. So you can actually harvest the bulbs and eat the bulbs as well.
I've never tried the bulb.
Yeah. The flowers are actually white for garlic chives and they're larger. They're not quite as cold hardy as common chives. So they're zoned from zone 4 to 9. They're easy to plant from seeds or transplants, although I prefer transplants because the seeds can take a little bit longer. Like Emily said, you would have wanted us to start those in March. They grow best in full sun. but they will tolerate light shade. The soil needs to be moist, fertile, rich, and well-draining. You have minimal care for established plants, so you can basically plant them and water them, and, you know, they'll live for years to come. The only thing that I would suggest is be mindful when planting this herb. It can spread, especially if you allow the flowers to fully develop and then go to seed. However, if this happens, it's really easy to dig up and move or share with a friend. So after you've planted chives, you can begin to harvest them 30 days after transplant or 60 days after germination for seeding. The chive plant flowers in late spring. And like I said before, the flowers are edible and they are absolutely delicious in salads. When it comes time to harvest, just cut them simply straight across, but be warned, once you trim chives, they will not come back. So if you want a steady supply, you want a succession cut. So only cut a little bit at a time. And I don't do a lot of cutting on mine. I take off about, you know, a third or half and then move on to another section of mine. Caring for them throughout the season is really easy. They're very drought tolerant, but it is important to give them consistent watering through the growing season, especially if it's been a few weeks without water. They are a great companion plant in the garden. You can plant them next to carrots and tomatoes, but please avoid planting them next to beans and peas. They really don't get along very well. They're like brothers and sisters, you know. So other benefits of chives, they are a great pollinator plant. The bees love those edible flowers. They also are said to repel aphids and Japanese beetles. So you can plant them next to susceptible plants. So if you know that maybe your knockout roses are going to really attract some Japanese beetles, why not plant a little chive plant next to them?
Japanese beetles really love basil. So that might be a good thing to like put them next to each other in your garden.
Maybe. I mean, I always plant my chives next to my basil. I have one section that's always herbs. Probably should rotate it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Anyway. All right, Emily, can you tell us about thyme?
I can tell you a little bit about thyme. So thyme is a herb that's actually part of the mint family. It's known for aroma and flavors of its dry leaves and flowering tops. So this is one where you're not necessarily using fresh leaves as much as the dry leaves. It's native to Eurasia and has been cultivated throughout the world, and there are actually over 300 varieties of thyme. It is, however, a slow-growing herb, so it's one that we recommend using clippings or buying transplants for. If you do want to start it from seed, you would need to start that seed in late winter, early spring, so like March time, in order to have those plants ready to go outside. Most thyme varieties are hardy in the United States from zones 5 to 9, but they do tend to dislike really hot, humid summers or overly wet conditions. Most varieties of thyme prefer full sun and well-drained soil. With a little research, even with adverse conditions, however, there are some varieties of thyme plants that are suitable for most growing habitats. They are kind of a low ground herb, so they do look really great kind of on the ground as more of a decorative plant, even if you don't want to use them for culinary things, so between pavers or stones, on patios and walkways. Other varieties grow a little bit more upright and can be standalone specimens in gardens or in pots. I would say that if you are growing one out in like a walkway or something like that, we would not recommend that you harvest that one for food consumption. So you would use that more as a decorative, or again, maybe in like a sensory component, but not necessarily for a harvesting for human consumption. They can withstand heat with regards to cooking, making them a fairly easy thing to add to things like breads and dough and soups and stocks. Pollinators love their tiny little white flowers as well.
I actually love the variegated varieties of thyme. Yeah. I mean, the leaves are so teeny tiny, but they have so many different colors and variegations and heights, as decorative as it is culinary.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about lining walkways with any type of herb is that if you brush up against them or they hang over or something, you get that nice sensory experience of smelling the herb.
Yeah.
I have a thyme plant that I've had for about 5 years in my container gardens. And it's really easy for me just to pick off a stem and put it in some soil in a pot. And then I have another bunch of thyme that I will have a plant at the end of the growing season. It's also a really good plant now to do if you have like a friend's birthday coming up or some type of, you know, housewarming gift that you want to give for the winter, to go ahead and start it now. And then you'll have a bunch of little thyme plants that you can give away.
Actually, that's a great idea in general, is giving potted herbs as gifts, because you can often buy like a tiny pot too, so you aren't spending a ton of money.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, they do make really great gifts.
They do.
Yeah. And I think the nice thing about them is, even if you have people that may not be huge plant lovers, the usefulness of herbs does make them sort of a nice backup thing for, you know,
exactly,
or as a gift. And in general, herbs tend to be pretty easy plants to take care of. A lot of times they flourish when you're not bathing them. Herbs tend to do better when they're forgotten and left alone.
Yep. I forget my herbs all the time.
Well, I know we all have our different idea of what our favorite herbs is. And actually picking a favorite herb is like impossible because there are so many good ones. And of course, I picked herbs that are native herbs, but I should have picked a more conventional choice.
Nah.
Yeah, I think if I had to pick one, I'd say Thai basil. I'll stick with that. But in terms of some native herbs that are around, I actually really like spicebush, which is a native shrub. And even though they do produce little red berries that you can dry and use as an alternative for like allspice, it's got kind of actually a peppery flavor. I think it's actually more like a peppercorn than anything. It's actually really nice to use both dried and fresh. But you can also use the twigs and leaves in a tea. And I actually enjoy the flavor of the tea as well. But it's awfully strong. So I thought with native herbs or like a shrub, I would need to leave them sitting in the water for a very long time. That is not so. You don't need to let it steep. Otherwise, it gets like way too strong. You can actually make spicebush jelly out of the tea. And it, again, like, I think if you added sugar and made a jelly out of it, oh my gosh, it would be baller. And actually, if you want to learn more about spicebush, I talk about it in great detail in our March episode for 2021.
It was your native plant of the month.
It was my native plant of the month. And there's a reason that it's one of my favorites. But anyways, and I also really enjoy anise hyssop, which is a perennial, and it looks a lot more like a traditional herb, but it's actually native to our area. So that is Agastache funiculum, I believe.
I can't believe you didn't say like bee balm or mountain mint.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do like bee balm, but I was trying to pick something a little bit different.
I love hyssop though.
And then another herb I really like is actually bayberry. And it's it's Morella or Myrica pennsylvanica is the northern bayberry, but we also have a southern bayberry. And it's sometimes used as a substitute for a bay leaf. It's called bayberry because it has a very similar smell and use to a bay leaf, even though the bay leaf we use in culinary purposes actually doesn't originate from here at all. But it's also a shrub that is called wax myrtle, and that's because a female produces berries that are very like dark blue, dark purple, and they have like a waxy coating on them. And so when you boil them down, it creates a type of wax that they used to use as like a substitute for beeswax or something. Those are just a couple of native herbs that are probably my favorite.
Awesome.
What about you, Emily? What's your fave?
I will say my fave herb when it comes to like my own consumption is mints. I have mints on my counter all winter long. I have mints that I grow all summer long in containers because they can be a little bit of bully plants. But I love having mint plants because I can take a few leaves of mint and put it in like water, and then it like, you crush them up a little bit and it makes the water just taste really good. And it's a really easy to use herb in that way. And then I do have some of the cat mint up in my front yard. But a lot of the herbs that I actually grow, I grow for bugs more than for my own self. So these would be things like dill, parsley, and fennel. I'm always growing for those swallowtail caterpillars, and I love being able to find them at the end of summer on those herbs. And then I also will grow things like calomel, and again, the mints are another one, especially when you let them go to flower. You find all kinds of insects buzzing all over them. A lot of our native bees love them. You'll get a lot of tiny wasps and big wasps, things like hoverflies and robber flies. But when you are going to grow herbs in your pollinator garden, it's sort of the opposite of growing them for food, because for food, you really don't want those herbs to go to flower, because the herb themselves will start to change their flavor because they're changing their energy from leaf into flower production. So versus your pollinators in particular want those flowers. So you kind of need to decide when you're planting an herb, are you going to use it for culinary purposes or is it going to be something for the bugs?
That's a really good point.
That's a good distinction.
Rachel, what are some of your favorite herbs?
Well, I'm pretty much with you, Emily. I really love mint. I like to grow pineapple mint and apple mint and just regular spearmint. I love those for teas. And my second favorite herb is dill. I do a lot of canning, either with making pickles or dilly beans, or just making broth. So dill is a wonderful addition to all of those. So dill is great for either growing directly in the ground or in a container. There aren't that many varieties of dill, but I like to grow mammoth because it gets over 5 foot tall. And then if you are looking for dill for a container, fern leaf is a great dwarf variety that only gets about 18 inches tall. It's a host plant for the black swallowtail, like Emily mentioned. They are a prolific reseeder, so just be conscious of that when you're planting them in your garden, especially if you let them go to seed. You're going to have it next year. So pick a spot where you're okay with that happening.
It's the Native Plants of the Month with Michaela.
So actually, in sticking with the theme of the episode, I thought I would stick to something that's kind of perceived as being an herb, which is wild ginger. And this is a Serum canadense. So it's a native ground cover to our area, but contrary to what its name suggests, is it's not an actual ginger. So it's very different from the stuff you're buying in the store. And even though it was historically used as a substitute for ginger, it actually doesn't have much culinary application in today's times. So sorry, it's kind of a letdown, but still I will consider it kind of an herb.
Is any native plant really a letdown though, Michaela?
That's right, it's not. And it also happens to be blooming in May. So I'm going to tell you how to find those blooms because they're pretty hidden. So this is a great native ground cover for heavy shade or wooded areas, especially if you have a woodland garden. This is a really nice addition. It has an extremely wide native growing range from as far west as North Dakota to south to Mississippi and north to even parts of Canada. So it grows in a pretty wide variety of areas, actually. It tolerates a variety of different soil types as well. But what's nice is that it can handle some of the heavy or moist soil types. So even in our clay soils around here, it can grow fairly well. Again, although it's named ginger because of the aroma is very gingery, and that historical use is that it was a ginger alternative. We don't really use it and don't recommend it for culinary consumption today. The flowers, however, should be blooming right about now, and they will be very small and like dark red purple, and they're kind of oddly placed at the base of the plant. So you need to look under the leaves. And May apples are the same way, which is a spring ephemeral that's, you know, around this time of the month as well. But the flowers are going to be found on the underside of the leaves. So you need to kind of look at the base. But it's not really grown for its flowers. It's really grown because it has a lovely texture. It's got these like heart-shaped leaves that are really attractive. And they are semi-evergreen, meaning, well, in the Eastern Shore, they're pretty evergreen. They stick around almost all winter. And they spread by rhizome. So it's not aggressive, though. You know, a lot of things that spread by rhizomes can really take over an area, but it's actually not aggressive at all. It might even be on the slower side of, you know, filling in an area as a ground cover. So this is actually one of my first recommendations for people who are looking for something to cover the ground, either to prevent erosion or they're looking at a woodland garden and thinking about what they can grow. It does not reach much higher than 12 inches. So it makes a really, really nice textured ground cover and a great edging for a woodland garden as well. And I've often seen it recommended as a companion for spring ephemerals, because it kind of sticks around and it has multi-season benefits, whereas the spring ephemerals emerge in a woodland garden and they look really great and then they like die back immediately and you never see them the rest of the year. So this is a really nice thing to mix in with those. And it also doesn't hurt, last little note, that it is deer resistant.
Nice. I was going to ask that.
Yeah, it's not deer proof. We don't promise that in a lot of plants, because if deer are hungry enough, they often will find something. But it is deer resistant, so they will tend to leave it alone. And if you have a woodland garden, deer can be a pressure in that kind of area.
I think that we have that all across Maryland, you know, the high deer pressure. So adding this plant to your garden would give you a lot of bang for your buck, right?
Yeah, it's great for areas, especially that may be too shady for growing grass or as a ground cover. So again, it's one of those things that I recommend as a native ground cover.
Awesome. Thanks, Michaela.
That's a really cool native plant.
Yeah. It is very cool. I feel like we don't really give it enough credit because it is really multifaceted and very tolerant of a lot of activity.
What's buzzing? It's the bug of the month with Emily. So this was a little tricky because I almost went with swallowtail caterpillars because we were talking about herbs, but I did want to talk about something that was a common pest that I know I get questions starting beginning of May about, which is rose slug sawflies. So these are a common pest that you're going to find on roses in the springtime. And we've got three species that we find here in Maryland. So the rose slug sawfly, the curled rose slug, and the bristly rose slug. The feeding damage on these is going to be on the leaves of wild and cultivated roses. And you're going to find them starting to feed. We have a really warm spring as early as the end of April, but normally it's somewhere at the beginning of May through June. And their feeding is going to be a skeletonization or window painting look. So what they're going to basically do is when they're super small is they're just going to be able to chew like the top or bottom part of the leaf. And it's going to leave kind of little brown tan squares. And as they get a little bigger, they can chomp through the whole leaf, but they're never going to feed all the way through onto the veins just because the vein's a little bit tougher and not quite as yummy. The leaves will eventually brown up, curl, and dry. So it causes a lot of cosmetic damage, but honestly, they're gone by June and most of your roses are going to flourish and put on more leaves that can kind of overcompensate. So if you decide not to treat for these, you're okay. You're not going to really have like long-term health effects on your roses. It's just a cosmetic issue. We do just get one generation per year. The adults are going to emerge in spring, lay their eggs in the leaves. Those eggs are going to hatch. The larvae are going to emerge. And again, late April, early May, and they're going to kind of crawl around and they're going to feed. And then near the mid to end June, they actually crawl down the plant and they pupate in the soil to emerge next year. Now, a lot of people get confused because they see these larvae and they think that they're either slugs or they think that they're caterpillars because they have a very caterpillar look, but they in fact are not caterpillars. They're not part of Lepidoptera. They don't become butterflies and moths. They actually become a sawfly, which is part of Hymenoptera. So it's related to wasps and bees. So you can tell the three common species apart by the way they look. So the rose slug sawfly is going to be a yellow green color with an orange head. The curly rose slug is more of a metallic green, but it's going to have little white dots over it. And it's going to have a yellow to brown head. The bristly rose slug is going to be about 5/8, and it's going to be green with bristles along it. So when it comes to controlling these, early detection is the most important thing to do because that gives you the widest variety of ways to control. So you can easily hand pick off them or just pull off leaves that are heavily damaged. When they first hatch out, they're so small and they blend in with those leaves really well. So mid-May is probably when you really want to start checking and treating for them if needed. If your infestation is really large, you can try using things like insecticidal soaps or an actual commercial insecticide. You do want to make sure either way, if you are using either one of those, that you want to target the underside of the leaf, because that's normally where you're going to actually find these guys hanging out. So applying a chemical to the top of the leaf where they're not is not going to be effective. You want to make sure that you're applying that product when the larvae is still present and before the feeding damage becomes too extensive. If they've already done a ton of feeding damage, there's no point in trying to control them then, because at that point you can just pull off all of those leaves and the plant will put on new ones. Always read and follow instructions when you decide to use any chemical. And we would not necessarily recommend using oils for these, particularly near the end of the season, because oils have the likelihood of burning your rose plants.
And BT definitely won't do you any good because it, right, they're not a caterpillar. They're not Lepidopteras. So
they're not a caterpillar, and there's not a BT that is meant for Hymenoptera or wasps and bees. So BT is not going to really do much good for you with these. These are one of the few ones that I also normally say, like, hosing with water doesn't normally knock them off. They tend to be really good at grasping. And again, they're on the underside of the leaves, which makes it a little bit harder to just, like, hose them off. But I get these on my rose bushes, and I just go out and pluck the leaves off. The real kicker is that these guys go away in June, and then you get Japanese beetles following.
Get your tip of the month here with Rachel.
All right, so all those peas that you planted are going to begin to ripen. So pick those pods when they're tender to keep the plants producing. You can plant your worn seamed crops like tomatoes and peppers and squash after the danger of frost has passed. And on the eastern shore of Maryland, that's usually around Mother's Day. Also, mix a half a cup of ground lime with soil in the planting hole to prevent blossom end rot. Water each transplant with water-soluble fertilizer like compost tea or kelp extract to help get them off to a good start. You want to pinch the blooms from flowers and vegetable transplant before you set them out. This will help direct the plant's energy to root development and will result in more productive plants. Pinch off tomato suckers to encourage larger, earlier fruit, especially if you're training to one central stem. And there's a great video on our HGIC YouTube page for pinching off tomato suckers. Your cool season crops like lettuce, broccoli, kale, and radishes may begin to bolt. This means flower. If this happens, it's time to remove them and make room for your warm season plants. Summer annual bulbs like gladiolus, elephant ear, begonias, cannas, and dahlias can be planted now. One of my favorite varieties of dahlia is the Thomas Edison. It's a huge dinner plate dahlia. It's a deep purple. It's absolutely beautiful. Check it out. You might love it for your garden. Prune your azaleas, rhododendrons, and other spring flowering shrubs if they're growing too large. But remember to prune them right after they bloom. And that goes for our summer hydrangeas. You prune those right after they bloom. Don't wait longer than that because you're going to hurt the buds for next year. Ticks are active when the temperature is above freezing, which is now. Wear light-colored clothing and get in the habit of checking yourself, your loved ones, and your pets for ticks after spending time indoors. Repellents are also an effective tool to keep ticks away. Emily, what are some of those repellents?
So we recommend using DEET. Tends to be the best one for ticks. Oil of lemon eucalyptus is a really good one for mosquitoes, but is kind of hit and miss with ticks. So we honestly recommend either using a clothing barrier or DEET on your open skin. Do not apply DEET to skin that is going to be covered with clothing. You can also buy permethrin and treat your actual pants and shoes with that, and that will cause any ticks that come on them to kind of clench up and fall off. So it's another great thing that you can use, and that's easily found at a lot of your sporting goods stores, hunting stores, and big box stores.
Awesome. Thanks, Emily. So if you've purchased a lot of plants to put in the ground, remember to get those planted before the heat of the summer comes. Also, you need to remember to water your baby transplants, and it's also a good time to set up any drip irrigation or hosing that you may want to use for your summer watering. So if you're seeing any wilted leaves on any of your shrubs, remember that we had some pretty cold nights the end of March into early April, and this could be frost damage. However, if you have any questions, you can always send us a picture with an email, and our email is umegardenpodcast@gmail.com. Well, that's all we have for this episode, listener. We hope you'd enjoyed it, and we'll tune in next month for more gardening tips. If you have any garden-related questions, please email us at umegardenpodcast@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook at Garden Time Podcast. That's Garden THYME. For more information about the University of Maryland Extension and these topics, please check out the University of Maryland Extension Home and Garden Information Center at go.umd.edu/HGIC. Thanks for listening and have fun getting down and dirty in your garden.
Goodbye!
The Garden Time Podcast is brought to you by the University of Maryland Extension. Michaela Boley, Senior Agent Associate in Talbot County for Horticulture, Rachel Rhodes, Agent Associate for Horticulture in Queen Anne's County, and Emily Zobel, Senior Agent Associate for Agriculture in Dorchester County.
University of Maryland Extension programs are open to all and will not discriminate against anyone because of race, age, sex, color, sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, physical or mental disability, religion, ancestry or nation of origin, marital status, genetic information, or political affiliation.
What about you, Sweetie Pie? What's your favorite herb? She goes, I like catnip.
I was just going to say, gotta be catnip.
Gotta be catnip. I don't know if cat grass counts as an herb or not. Yeah.
Oh, I can hear it. Yeah, mm-hmm. She purrs.
You purring.